Tonight's shiur is dedicated for Sima Rochel Ben, Sima Rochel Bas, Harav Tzvi Aryeh. Parshas Miketz, I believe, is a very emotionally driven parsha. There's a lot of up and down emotions that take place in this week's parsha. There's some good emotions, some negative emotions, some scary emotions, some exciting emotions. In the beginning of the parsha, or I'd call the first half of the parsha, we find the success, so to say, of Yosef literally being taken out of a prison to becoming second in command. That's a pretty big deal. That's a big experience. That's the beginning half of the parsha. Yosef has his salvation from what seemed to be a life sentence in jail. He has his salvation where he comes out, where he becomes, not only does he become free, he becomes the second most important person in the entire country. And then we find later on in the parsha what I call the emotional roller coaster that takes place by the brothers. Yosef gives his brothers a little bit of a run for their money, where he really puts them through the ringer, as we'd say, where he really runs them tough emotionally about, you know, who can come, and Binyamin and Shimon, and locking them up in jail. It's a very emotionally driven parsha. Plus the fact that Parshas Miketz almost always coincides with Chanukah. So clearly whatever we're going to learn in Parshas Miketz, there must be some similarity to the Chanukah experience or the lessons from Chanukah. The pasuk opens up with the word Vayihi. The Gemara tells us in Megillah that whenever you find the word Vayihi, it's always Lashon Tsar. It's always negative. The Gemara says Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh, the beginning of the Purim story. The Gemara actually asks, but we find another place in the Torah, Vayihi b'yom Hashmini, which is actually related to Chanukah. When they, on the eighth day, after when they put up the Mizbeach, that was one of the most joyous days in Jewish history. So why is the pasuk use the word Tsar? So the Gemara says, because although at that time it was happy, but because since Aaron's two sons are going to die, later on in the parasha, it's a Lashon Tsar. So the question is, why is Vamiketz Lashon Tsar? What's so sad about this week's parasha? So the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh has two pshatim. His first pshat, I don't claim to understand. I'll repeat the words, but I don't really understand what he means. He writes, Shahagolus, he writes over here, because Kiato Yaschil Lisaivev Sibas Golus Mitzrayim. Because this week's parasha is going to be the beginning where we discuss what he calls the Sibas Golus Mitzrayim, the reason for the Golus. Meaning it's really what I call is cause and effect. Because of last week's parasha, that's why we're now going to start what's known as Golus Mitzrayim. But he brings a second shot. His second shot is the reason why it's Lashon Tsar is because we're about to enter into a hunger. The entire world is going to be in a hunger. Eretz Canaan and Eretz Mitzrayim. The entire world, all the world, not just Jewish people, all people are going to be experiencing tsar. We're all going to be uncomfortable when we're hungry. Says the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, that when we're all in tsar, Chazal tell us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in tsar as well. He writes over here, B'shuas Yakiki HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kaviyochol Loi Tsar B'tsaras Olamoy. Hashem himself feels tsar when his world is in tsar. Again, not only Jews. This wasn't a Jewish event. This was a world event. All the world. Mitzrayim, Jews, Eretz Canaan. Everyone experienced the tsar of the hunger. Therefore, writes Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, that's why the parasha opens up with the Lashon of Vayitzar. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself feels the pain of the people that we go through when we ourselves suffer. This is somewhat of a nechama for all of us. When we've experienced private or individualized suffering, we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is suffering along with us. But I believe there's a direct connection to this idea of the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, to the Yom Tov of Chanukah, which we're in the middle of celebrating. We find something extremely unique about the Yom Tov of Chanukah. The Yom Tov of Chanukah, we find, brought down by many paiskim, that there's a specific inyan to give tzedakah on Chanukah. More than other Yom Tovim. Supposed to give tzedakah on Chanukah. Why exactly is there a reason to give tzedakah on Chanukah? So I'd like to suggest, based on the Gemara. The Gemara in Shabbos tells us that after the whole story of Chanukah, the Gemara says one very important line. The Gemara says, L'shona acheres kavu v'aso yomtif. The first year, there was no yomtif of Chanukah. No donuts, no latkes, no dreidels, nothing. No Chanukah vacation, really nothing. Nothing kicked in till the next year. The first year on Chav Dalet, they won the war. They celebrated, they lit the menorah, the miracle happened, great. The next year, L'shona Acheres, Chazal instituted the Yom Tov of Chanukah. So many people ask, why'd you wait a year later? Do it right now. Call the Yom Tov Chanukah right now. We'll celebrate Chanukah right now, and we don't need to wait for another year. Why was it L'shona Acheres, Kavavo, Sam Yom Tov? So there are many pshatim given. One of the pshatim that are given was because many people lost family members in the war. Many people are suffering right now during the time of Chanukah. It wasn't right to make a Yom Tov at a time when people are suffering. Very nice. We're happy as a nation that we defeat our enemies. Yes, we're grateful, we're appreciative. But how can you make it a Yom Tov? People are suffering. People lost family members. People are recovering. When Klal Yisrael or another member of society is Betzara, although there's a reason for Mikra Yom Tov, it's not the right thing to do. Therefore, we waited till Lashana Acheres. We waited till another year, and then we made it a Yom Tov. Rav Salavitchik brought this Gemara LaHalacha. He felt you can't establish the Medina in 1948. He said, you have to follow the Gemara. You got to wait another year. Lashana Acheres. He said, just like in the times of the Gemara, they didn't make Hanukkah that year, they waited another year. Salavitchik writes, you have to wait another year. But the idea is very, very true, that it's not right for us to commemorate or to celebrate when people are still actively suffering. In 1970 or 1971, I believe, when Reb Huttner was, his airplane was hijacked by Arabs. And they spent a lot of time, the Jews in America were working tirelessly to get Reb Huttner off. And they finally got him off, and he was returned back to JFK. And when in the airport, there was a huge celebration for Reb Huttner. Everyone came to greet him, and there was music playing. And Reb Moshe Feinstein came as well. And Reb Moshe Feinstein told the band, stop playing. So they asked Reb Moshe Feinstein why. He said, because although we're very grateful that Reb Huttner is being returned, there are still people that have family members that are captured. How can you rejoice and dance and sing when there are people that are still suffering? This is mamish, the idea that we're seeing right over here. That when someone else is suffering, we have to feel their suffering. So if that's the pshat of Chanukah, now I understand why there's a special inyan to give tzedakah on Chanukah. Because the whole Yom Tov of Chanukah is based on how can I enjoy when someone else is suffering? How can I enjoy my latkes and donuts if I know there's a person who can't afford latkes and donuts? Or a person is struggling, a person can't afford to pay his bills, and I'm going to sit back and enjoy myself. That defeats the whole idea of the Yom Tov. The whole idea of the Yom Tov was to think about someone else. So that's why I believe there's a specific inyan on Chanukah to give tzedakah la'aniyim. Because that was the whole idea of the Yom Tov. And that's what we're seeing from the Arachayim HaKadosh, why the Torah says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Bitzar, because the hunger is about to befall, even though there's some great things that are going to happen in the Parsha. Yosef becomes second in command, that's a great thing. But at the end of the day, when people suffer, HaKadosh Baruch Hu suffers, and we're obligated to follow the ways of Hashem, so we're supposed to feel the pain and suffering of others. Although we're allowed to have our enjoyment, of course, no question. But sometimes we have to realize that we have to feel the suffering of others. So what happens in this Parsha? Yeah. Purim we have Matanis Levyanim as well, and we have on Pesach, we have on Pesach also to give, that's because of the high expenses of Pesach, and on Sukkot we also maybe have. But we find the concept that by Chanukah, maybe we'll talk, we talked I think about this last year in the Halachah when we talked about why we give presents to our kids. So we mentioned that a lot of this came from the fact that one of the pshatim was that people felt that we don't spend enough money on Chanukah. They obviously didn't see how much the menorahs cost. But okay, it used to be Chanukah was a cheap Yom Tov. What did it cost on Chanukah? A little oil, one candle, you're good to go. So they wanted to show that we want to spend money on things. So that's why they give tzedakah, and that's why they do things like that. There's some other pshatim. Maybe we'll get to it later tonight. So what happens at the beginning of this week's parasha? Beginning of this week's parasha, we're exposed to dreams. Dreams. There's a serious idea about dreams. The Gemara and Brachas discussed at length the idea of dreams. There's a concept called Atovas Chaloyim. The person has a very scary dream. They're supposed to be mate of it. They're supposed to go to someone who could interpret it in a positive way. Because the Gemara says dreams go based on the interpretation. The Gemara tells us in Brachas that when we have a duchening, here in Chutz Laaretz, it's not so frequent. It's only on Yom Tovim. So there's a special Ribbono Shel Olam that we recite, that's supposed to help for us for those of us who have bad dreams, we're supposed to go say those tefillas. There is an Aruch HaShulchan, an interesting idea from the Aruch HaShulchan. He writes that today bad dreams don't have the same power as they used to. He says, Amol used to be you lived in the middle of nowhere. So your dreams are going to be a reflection of a shtickle nevuah. But he says, the Aruch HaShulchan, talking about the late 1800s, culture came today. If a person has a scary dream, you know why he has a scary dream? Because he watched something scary during the day. Today we're exposed to so many new things. We see things all the time. You watch something scary, you saw a scary thing, so that's why you're going to dream about it. The Gemara says you dream about what you think about. So if a person, for no reason, would see two people kill each other, then he has a dream. Oh, it's scary. But if a person is watching something scary, and he's seeing something very violent, and he's going to have a violent dream, that's not a riot to anything, besides for the fact that he saw a violent action earlier. So therefore, Aruch HaShulchan has this big chiddush where he believes that the whole idea of Atavas Chalim is really not applicable today for most of us. Kolshkin, if he lived in our day and saw that we see everything and anything in a second, he was talking about the late 1800s. But Kolshkin today, when the fact that if I see something scary, it's because, yeah, we probably saw it 2 days ago, 3 days ago, you watched it, you saw a clip, you saw a video, and therefore that's what's causing you to think about it. But in any case, there's a lot of significance given to dreams. So what was the first dream? We were exposed to Paro's dreams. What was Paro's dreams? Now what's interesting is, the Medrash tells us that Paro had this occurring dream for 2 years straight. For 2 years straight, Paro had this exact same occurring dream night after night. Now, what exactly was the dream? So it's very interesting. If you look at the psukim, the dream kind of changes from when the Torah tells us what Paro experienced to what Paro tells Yosef experienced. It's a different version. Different version to the dream. So the way Paro tells us the story, what happened is, Paro tells us the way the Torah tells us what Paro's dream was. He's by the river, and the Sheva Paros Yifos Mareh, beautiful cows. So the Mefarshim pointed out, Yifos Mareh is usually when you're talking about physical beauty. You talk about someone who's a Yafa, a person is pretty. You know, you don't call a cow pretty. It can produce, you know, it can produce whatever you need it for, but you wouldn't call it pretty. Yifos Mareh is not generally a term you use for an animal, but okay. So you have these beautiful, powerful seven cows, and they're by the swamp. And all of a sudden comes these paros acheros, comes these other animals. They are ra'ois, ma'rev, and dakospos. So they're very thin and ugly to look at. The exact opposite. Strong versus weak. And they're standing next to the paros. So the Kliyaka points out, what does it mean they're standing next to the paros? What's the importance of standing next to the paros? So the Kliyaka says that they were so weak, they needed the stronger ones to hold them up. It was as if the strong ones were holding up the weak paros. They were so shvach, they were so weak, they needed to be held up by the strong ones. Says the Kliyaka, this is supposed to, or this was what Yosef was thinking to himself, he was saying, wow, this is supposed to allude to those seven tough years that are going to be so bad, those 7 years of hunger, that the only way they're going to be survived is because they're being held up by the 7 years of plentiful. That's what triggered Yosef in his mind. This Sefarno has a different shot. He suggests that the reason why they're together is because there was somewhat of an overlap between the good years and the bad years. There was an overlap, so that's why they're next to each other. What happens? They eat it up. The weak ones eat up the strong ones. Now again, it doesn't say the weak ones still looked weak. That's only when Paro tells it over to Yosef. The way the Torah dictates the story, it does not say anything about and the skinny ones still look skinny. Doesn't say that. When the kids come from school, they tell over the parsha, they always say that part. That's half the story. That's the way Paro said it to Yosef. It's not the way the Torah dictates from Paro himself. And what happens? Vayikatz Paro, and Paro wakes up. Paro wakes up from his dream. Reb Shamsher for Hush explains, Vayikatz Paro, as Paro was like scared. It was like, it so to say, freaked him out. When he saw these weak, you know, shvacha paro, it bugged him. He couldn't handle it. Vayikatz. He says vayikatz over here is not only to mean to wake up, but from lashon to be disgusted. He was so like repulsed by what he saw. These dilapidated, malnourished animals. It was something he couldn't handle, and that's what caused him to wake up. Yet look at the next pasuk, vayishan. He goes right back to sleep. So Reb Hirsch suggests that he didn't really wake up. You know, sometimes when you're having a bad dream, you wake up, you're not really up. You don't really get up and walk around and start your day. He just ended the dream, Vayishan, went right back to sleep, and the dream came back. That's the way Rav Hirsch explains what happened over here. He never really woke up. Vayishan doesn't mean he woke. Vayikatz Paro doesn't mean he really woke up from his full sleep. He got up from, you know, from that dream, but he was still in the sleep mode and went right back to sleep. And then he has a second dream. There's a bit of a machoikish rishonim. What is the significance of the smaller ones eating the big ones? What exactly is that supposed to show us? So Rashi learns it's supposed to show us that we'll completely forget the good years. The bad years are going to be so bad of hunger that we're not even going to remember that it was preceded by seven good years of eating. That's the way Rashi learns. The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban learns that what's supposed to show is that the seven strong years are going to support the seven bad years. That's the way the Ramban learns. What happens in his next dream? Next dream tells us, so just on a side note, Rav Steinman Zatzal points out that when Paro saw this, he saw a live animal eat another live animal, which is pretty amazing today. He didn't say that it doesn't say in the pasuk that one paro killed the other paro and then ate it. He ate it live. He says this is an unbelievable thing to experience. He ate it live. And he says that's something which is totally abnormal. No one ever thinks about things like that. One animal eats another animal, yeah, you fight, you kill the other one, then you chew its head off. But to swallow a live animal, that's something, it's only on YouTube, such a godless like that. That wasn't even something on Paro's radar. Points at Reb Steinman, that's the way the psukim seem to imply. So what happens? And he wakes up and he has another dream. Okay? What's his next dream? His next dream is not about animals, but instead his next dream has to do with the fact that there are storks. And again, the same theory, strong ones and the weak ones eat up the strong ones. And after this, Paro had enough, and then it was time for him to wake up. So what happens over here? The pasuk tells us, Vayikatz Paro v'inei chaloim, and behold, it was a dream. Says Rav Hirsch again, when Paro was living these dreams, it felt so real to him. He didn't realize he was dreaming. It wasn't only till later when he said, oh, Vayikas Parah, when he woke up, he said, wow, that was a dream. He really thought it was so real-like. The dreams were so vivid to him. They were so clear. He thought he was actually living it. That's why the pasuk says, Vayikas, he woke up, and then he said, oh, Baruch Hashem, was a dream. Like we all know, we have a real scary dream. Sometimes it seems so real to us. We have to like get out of that mode. So Parah had that experience where he had to say to himself, oh, it's only a dream. I'm able to move on. So the question over here that one has to ask, and I saw the question asked by Reb Schwab, he says, since when does Parah care so much about dreams? We dream all the time. We don't lose too much sleep over it. Parah was so freaked out about these dreams. And he went over to everyone to get an interpretation, and no one had a good interpretation. Just move on, Parah. You got bigger problems. You're running a massive country. You're so worried about a dream? So I would have suggested the simple answer might be, is that it might be cultural. Right? It could be in the Egyptian culture, bad dreams was a bad omen or something like that. And that was shaking Parah up. But if Schwab doesn't understand, why was Parah so shaken by this idea that you have a scary dream? Okay, you have a scary dream, you move on. Why was this, so to say, controlling him? So Schwab suggests the following idea. He suggests like this. He says, because really he had nothing to be nervous about. What should he be nervous about? He's got himself a kingdom, he's a dictator, he's got an army, nothing to be worried about. But then Parah said to himself, what's going on in my dream? What's this reoccurring theme? The reoccurring theme in my dream is that the weak is defeating the strong. Right? The weak animal is eating the big animal. The weak stalks are eating the big stalks. So says Reb Schwab, Parah said to himself, you know what? Maybe there is like this small underground revolt of a small army that will overtake my big army. That's what got him so nervous. It wasn't the fact that it was just a dream. It was what the dream connotated was the idea that sometimes, although you're the underdog, and you can ask this to anyone who ever bets on sports, sometimes the underdog will win. Believe it or not, it happens. So that's what got Parah all stirred. He said that my dreams keep on showing me that the underdog is winning. So he said to himself, okay, now I have what to be nervous about. Because this might be reflecting of a revolution that's taking place by a small minority of my country, but sometimes the small will defeat the large. Says Reb Schwab, that's why we always read Parshas Mikates beChanukah. What was the lesson of Chanukah? V'rabim miyad ma'atim. The whole idea of Chanukah, says Reb Schwab, was we were a teeny little army. Who were we? We were a bunch of untrained soldiers going up one of the greatest armies. And yet we succeeded and we won. So it's the lesson that sometimes it's not necessarily about how strong and how powerful you are. It's about who, if you're on the right side, and you're doing what's right, you're doing Hashem's will, that you can succeed even though the numbers are down. The B'nai Yisachar explains this minute that we've spoken about in other shirim, that we give out Chanukah geld, we give presents, we give money to children. So he thinks the minute is to give small gifts. I told this to my students in school today. I told them, just don't tell your parents this. Tell them you're supposed to give expensive gifts. You're supposed to give small gifts, little things. Why, says the B'nai Yisachar? Because what's the whole idea of Chanukah? The idea of Chanukah is that it's not about how big you are, how strong you are, how powerful you are. Sometimes it's the small things that make a difference. The little things. You say to yourself, a small army, a bunch of Jews got together and fought, and they were small. Weren't very powerful, probably weren't trained, and they were able to survive. That's the idea why we give small money to children. Show them, listen, it might not look like a lot to you, but you'd be shocked how far it can go, what it can mean. And he adds, and that's the connection between the Pachim Ketanim. Yaakov Avinu went back for Pachim Ketanim. The Gemara tells us the Chum. We spoke about this last time we were together. And many people make this connection between the Pach Shemen and the Pach Tanim of Yaakov Avinu. Says B'nai Yisoscha, the connection is the idea that not everything in life has to be massive and huge. The small things in life also can be very big. It's not always how you measure things. Therefore, says the B'nai Yisoscha, the lesson of Chanukah, and this is the same thing over here also, the lesson is that we don't necessarily measure greatness by how big or small something is, but greatness is really dependent upon you. If you have a will to succeed and you want to be great, you can be great, no matter how big you look. Even though you are the underdog, you still have the ability to become great. So explains Reb Schwab, that's the connection to why Parshas Mikates is almost always on Shabbos Chanukah, because this lesson, this is what bothered Parah, this is what made Parah nervous. He thought to himself, maybe the underdog will win, and then I'll be overthrown. So what does he do? So the Pasuk tells us, when he wakes up in the morning, he calls anyone he could, he even asks his chatumim. Everyone, give me some form of an interpretation, I need some clarity, I can't move on. I need to know what's going on. So what happens? The pasuk tells us something very interesting. In the middle of nowhere, the Saramashkim gets involved over here. We haven't heard about the Saramashkim since last week's parasha. The Saramashkim didn't keep his end of the deal. The Saramashkim was asked in last week's parasha by Yosef, do me a favor, go speak nicely on my behalf. He never did that. We don't find anywhere. The first time we hear about it is over here. What happens? The pasuk tells us the Sahar Mashkim comes to Paroi and says, Paroi, I have an idea for you. I have a great guy, the guy you're looking for. So the Medrash asks, he says, what motivated the Sahar Mashkim to come help? It wasn't because he cared about Yosef. Because if he cared about Yosef, he woke up a little too late. There was a lot going on during all this time. It's an unbelievable Medrash. The Medrash says the Sahar Mashkim was worried about his own life. The Sahar Mashkim said to himself, I barely survived. I just got saved. What's going to happen? I'm friendly with the old Paroi, the Paroi that we know of. But the Medrash says Paroi was so stressed about his dreams, the Sahar Mashkim was afraid Paroi was going to give himself a heart attack. And Paroi was going to die. And there'd be a new Paroi. The Sahar Mashkim said to himself, I don't know if I can survive another Paroi. I got a good relationship with this Paroi. I got to make sure this Paroi stays in office. So he said to himself, okay, how do I make sure this Paroi stays in office? I got to calm him down. Find for him someone that can calm his nerve. The words of the Medrash says, the Sahar Mashkim was convinced that Paroi was so stressed out, he was going to die from it. He was going to have a heart attack from it. So therefore, the Sahar Mashkim was completely shalei lishma. The Sahar Mashkim did not do this for Yosef's benefit. You read the psukim, you get the impression that the Sahar Mashkim was a shtickle tzaddik. He was coming for Yosef because they made a deal in last week's parasha. I'll remember you. Nechdeke talk, says the Medrash. It was totally shalei lishma. The Sahar Mashkim was worrying about the Sahar Mashkim. He was afraid that if Paroi dies, he'll lose all his protection that he had with this Paroi. So therefore, he came up with this idea, let's get Yosef involved. So what happens? He comes to Paroi, and he tells him, Paroi, I have to tell you, I must admit that I did something wrong. The Rishonim will point out, which doesn't seem to work with the Medrash I just mentioned to you, that the Paroi over here is not the same Paroi. Paroi is just a general name. It's like saying president. Paroi wasn't the name of a person. Paroi was a general term used for the leader at that time. So many Rishonim suggest this is not the same Paroi that the Sahar Mashkim was in jail with. That doesn't seem to work with the Medrash I just mentioned, but many Rishonim on the Pasuk learn, Vayidab Sahar Mashkim es Paroi doesn't mean the Paroi that he spoke to in last week's parasha. The Paroi, the president, whoever the president was at that time, it wasn't necessarily the same person. So he tells him, let me tell you a story. I was once in jail. And when I was in jail, I met this terrific guy, this guy who knows how to tell dreams. But listen to the way he says it. He writes over here, I was in jail with the Beis Sar Tabachim, me and the Sar HaOifim. Why exactly is it relevant to know who you were in jail with? You were in jail. Look, you have to tell you who you were in jail. Why is it important for us to know you were in jail with the Sar HaOifim also? So Farshim point out, he was trying to build up Yosef's credibility. He was telling him, listen, there was two guys, and this guy who interpreted our dream really didn't know either one of us. And he knew that I was going to win. And not only was I going to come out, the other guy lost. The other guy was killed. This guy is real legit. He was trying to push the legitimacy of Yosef. Not because he cared about Yosef, according to the marriage, just because he didn't want Paroi dying. But he was trying to build up that Yosef is legit. Listen, I'm telling you, he's a good guy. Because we were two of us. Neither one of us had any better chance than the other guy. And his interpretation was that I survived and the other fellow died. It just builds up Yosef's credibility. And then he goes through the whole story, and I had a dream, and he interpreted it. But listen to what he says. V'shami tonu na'ar ivri. And he tells me, you should know that in this jail, there was a Jew. Eved l'sarat tabachim, and he interpreted it. So Rashi points out that every word of the Sahar Mashkim was a derogatory terminology used to describe Yosef. Which again is very much in line with the Medrash, that this was not a pious act of the Sahar Mashkim. This was an extremely self-motivated act by the Sahar Mashkim. And he says, Eved Ivri, Arurim Arishayim, says Rashi, cursed are the evil. She'ein Tevasim Shleima. Because even when they do something good, it's not legit, it's not real. Maskir Blashigna, they have to say it in a derogatory way. So Nar, says Rashi, is a Shaita. Ivri, what was the knack by calling him an Ivri? So it says Rashi, Afilu L'Shayneinu Eine Makir. He doesn't even know our language. He doesn't speak our language. That's a knock. So Shtaman points out, he says, one second, I have a question. If Yosef didn't speak Mitzri, so how exactly did Yosef have a conversation in jail with the Sarof and the Sar Mashkim? He didn't speak the language. How was Yosef able to interpret a whole dream when he doesn't speak a word of Mitzri? He's a Jewish boy, he speaks Hebrew, Kanani, whatever language they spoke. If Rashi's correct, he didn't speak any Mitzri, how exactly did he have a whole discussion with the Sar Oifim and the Sar Mashkim? He has a better kasha. He says, how was this whole conversation with Eishes Potiphar in last week's parsha? What were they talking about? Oh, I don't understand English, right? End the story. What's this whole back and forth? So Steinman suggested that maybe the pshat is that he understood it. He says it like this. He says, in every culture, there are certain words and phrases that you need to learn to survive in that country. You're not fluent in the language, but you know enough to get by, right? You ask anyone who's an immigrant to the country, they'll tell you they know exactly what to say to survive, you know, to get their job, to hold on to their job, they know what they need to say. So it's actually Meduik like that in Rashi. Rashi says, V'afilu shenenu in a makir, it doesn't recognize. It doesn't mean it doesn't know it. Ain't a makim means he's not recognizable, it's not fluent. He didn't speak a fluent Mitzri. He knew Mitzri. He was able to pass a conversation in Mitzri. He was able to hear Mitzri. But he wasn't fluent in Mitzri. Okay. So what happens? The Pasuk tells us right away, Yosef is taken out of jail. Vayishlach Paro vayikres Yosef. But that's all Paro needed to hear. He was convinced Yosef is the guy. He whisks him out of jail. Vayuitzihu min habor. He takes him out of the pit. So Rashi says, well, a pit. He wasn't in a pit. He was in a jail. So Rashi says, he means a jail. Fine. Vayigalach. And he gets a haircut. Vayichalev some myself, and he changes his clothing. Vayavel Paro. So the first one will point out, why this whole change? He wasn't freed from jail yet. He didn't get freed yet. He was just getting out of jail to meet with the king to see if the king is going to free him. So you see over here, the Rishonim point out that was Kavod HaMelech. Even just to see the king, not necessarily to be freed. Just to talk to the king, you have to look presentable, you have to get a haircut, a shave, change his clothing in order to talk to the king. The Achronim over here have what I would call a cute kasha, but they it's a serious kasha they're bothered with. They ask that, the Gemara tells us that this all took place in Rosh Hashanah. So Reb Chaim Kanevsky asks this, and Reb Asher Weiss, the Minchas Asher, has a whole tshuva about this. He says, how is he allowed to take a haircut in Rosh Hashanah? He said, I'll take a haircut in Rosh Hashanah. It's prohibited. So Reb Chaim Kanevsky suggests the following answer. He says, no. He says, it was due through a guy, Amir Lenochri. He tells that the Saramashkim gave him the haircut. I don't know how he knows this. The Saramashkim gave him the haircut. So it was Amir Lenochri. Amir Lenochri is an Issa D'Rabbanan. So there's a shita of Rishayim, which we don't necessarily pask like that, that Amir Lenochri is mutter for any mitzvah. Whatever the mitzvah is, Amir Lenochri is permissive. We don't pask like that. It's a shita of the Arzurah. So therefore, says Reb Chaim Kanevsky, says, since Kavod HaMelech is a mitzvah, so he was allowed to ask the Sar Mashkin to give him a haircut, because Amir Lenochri would tzarech mitzvah. So he paskins Reb Chaim Kanevsky. Reb Asher Weiss has a whole tshuva about this in his Sefer on Chumash, Minchas Asher. He has a whole back and forth about this, where he says there are those people that want to bring a raya, that you see from over here, that the mitzvah of honoring a non-Jewish king is a mitzvah deraisa. It's taken from the Torah. And that's why you're even allowed to be even an isser of shaving on Shabbos, which is an isser deraisa, in order to do another mitzvah deraisa. So Reb Asher Weiss takes big issue with that. He says, what are you talking about? Shaving is not an isser deraisa. Why? What malacha is shaving and getting a haircut? The malacha of geizes. The malacha of geizes is only when you want the hair. When we take haircuts and shave, we don't want the hair. So the Gemara calls that a malacha shein etzvicha leguf. I'm doing the outcome, but not for the reason. The halacha is, if you're doing the outcome, not for the reason, it's only nisa derabanan. So you don't have to come on to, you can't tell me that this would be nisa deraisa anyways. So the easy answer is pikuach nefesh. He was going to get killed. He didn't have a choice. It's not yagval yava. You don't have to die over it. So that's why he got a haircut. And therefore he came ready to look his most presentable way when he came to talk to the king. Okay. Right, so that was what we spoke about last time we were here. So the easy answer is, right, so we could answer what we said for Yaakov. Either like the Ramban, he only kept mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael, and he's clearly not in Eretz Yisrael, or like Reb Chaim Volozhin said, he kept mitzvahs as he felt necessary. And this one, yeah, I think that's the easier answer. Yeah, 100%. We're going to have to answer that anyways, because when we get later on in the parasha, we find that he married a nice mitzvah girl. Again, he married the daughter of Potiphar. Well, the Medrash says that was really Dina's daughter. But if you assume not like that, he married a Mitzri. Everyone asks, how can he marry a Mitzri? The answer is the same way his father did whatever he did. So either whatever answer you want to pick. Either he didn't keep Mitzri out of Eretz Yisrael, or he kept him as... That would be the other answer to this kasha, 100%. So what happens? He finally meets the great king. But here with Paro, Paro tells him, I have these dreams. He tells him the dream. And again, in Paro's repetition of the dream, he changes his storyline. He says that when they ate it, they still looked skinny. The Rashbam points this out. He says, what changed? Why when the Torah tells us the story, it doesn't have that? Yet when Paro tells over to Yosef, now you have an additive story, an additive piece of information. That's not there. To me, it's a strong question. You know, why exactly was it changed? If that was part of the story, so why does the Torah not tell it to us? Obviously it was integral, so why does the Torah not tell it to us when the Torah tells us the story? But in any case, Yosef comes up with this fantastic interpretation. What's Yosef's fantastic interpretation? His interpretation basically is that the whole story, the cows and the wheat and the bundles, it's all one idea. Says Yosef to Paro, it's one idea. There's going to be 7 good years, there's going to be 7 bad years. That's the whole idea. What Paro wanted to hear from somebody was that they're not 2 independent dreams. He wanted to hear that these 2 dreams have a connection. That's what he was looking at. No one was giving him that. Everyone was telling him that the 7 is referring to 7 daughters you're going to have and they're going to die. Or 7 countries you're going to conquer and they're going to be taken over later. Paro wanted to hear, because Paro was convinced that these two dreams are connected. It's not two independent dreams that both happen to have the number 7 and both happen to have, you know, abnormal activity. Paroi knew that there's a connection. He was waiting for someone to put that piece into the puzzle. And then when Yosef came and said, I'll tell you, Paroi, this is the deal, then that gave Paroi unbelievable nechama. And Paroi loved his interpretation. What was his interpretation? There's going to be 7 rough years, 7 good years, and the 7 good years are going to be very good, but the 7 years are going to be so bad, it's going to mask the 7 good years. Okay, the way we all know. But what happens after that is very interesting. What's very interesting is the pasuk continues, and all of a sudden Yosef becomes a financial advisor. Yosef's job was to interpret the dreams and stop talking. Yosef goes on. He starts telling Paroi, okay, so Paroi, now that I told you that, I have an idea. What we need to do is like this. He tells him, Vayato, Yarei Paroi ish navayim v'chacham. You have to appoint someone who's a navayim v'chacham. V'yishisei wal aretz Mitzrayim, he can run. Yaseh Paroi v'yafki pekidim al aretz. He gives his whole drasha what he should do. And he should start gathering all the food. There's a whole long drush over here of what he should do. He gives him all this advice. He tells him over here, and Pasuk Lamed Gimel, he tells him, V'yishisu al aretz. So as Machlokes was showing him what he wanted over here. Some say he was telling him that he should start charging a tax. These novel ideas. Who asked Yosef for his advice on how to finance Mitzrayim? Your job was to interpret. You told your interpretation. Done. Move on. Well, who gave Yosef the floor to start coming up with all these novel ideas of how to finance Mitzrayim during the hunger? That's not your job. You're not a financial advisor. You're an interpreter. So I always joke, maybe that's the way Yidden are. Like, we get an idea in our head. We present it even though it's not our place. Yosef was convinced this is the right way to do it. So he opened his mouth. They said, this is the way to do it. Chaim Kineski says a little different. He said that Yosef was trying to show Paroi, Paroi, I'm so convinced I'm right. I'm laying out all the details to this plan. I'm so convinced that what I just told you is correct, that the 7 years mean this and the 7 years mean that. I'm going to even give you details on how to financially set yourself up, because I know what I told you was right. He was selling his course. That's the way Reb Chaim Kineski explains why Yosef decided all of a sudden to become a financial advisor and start giving his idea of how things should work. Now, what's interesting is, he says you need to have someone who's Navoin V'Chachem. You need to have someone who's a Chachem. What was the job criteria for someone to take over and to manage Mitzrayim during this next point? So Rabbi Fran points out that the word chacham over here means someone who can see the future. Raya Sanayla. Points out, Rabbi Fran, he says a beautiful idea. He says that the idea over here is that Yosef was telling Paroi, I'm telling you what's going to happen. We're going to have 7 good years, and then we're going to have 7 bad years. The person that you're going to put in charge to run the next 14 years has to be someone who sees a big picture. If the person is short-sighted, all he sees is the good years, he's going to forget that we have to keep in mind 7 bad years are coming. You got to appoint someone who's a Navoin V'Chacham. What does a Chacham mean? Roya Es Hanoilat. He sees. That's what we call a big picture. The 7 years are going to be good, but if you're not thinking during these 7 years how I can save up for the next 7 years, it's going to easy go. So says Rabbi Fran, that's the lesson that Yosef was telling him. You need to have a Chacham. He says, this is not just a lesson for Paroi, this is a lesson for all of us. He says, we have to look at life as the 7 good years and the 7 bad years. Lahavdil. What does that mean? It means we have to look at our life and say, what is life all about? I'm living this world for the next world. Everything I'm doing in my daily life here is just a preparation for the next world. So I have to say to myself, I got to use this world and not have this small vision of I'm living for now, let me enjoy now, and that's all I care about. We have to keep in mind what's going to happen afterwards. What's going to happen when this world ends, and then we're going to say, wow, I could have done this, I should have done this. It's too late. But once the hunger years came, it was too late to say, oh, I should have saved, I should have invested. It's too late then. The Vilna Gaon used to say, on his deathbed, he held on to his tzitzis. He said, a simple mitzvah like this, in a few minutes, right before when I'm going to die, I'm not going to be able to do. Now is the time to invest. So he said that that's the lesson that we're supposed to take away, that we have to realize that the time for investing is now. Can't wake up later. My friend said over that a Rebbe once threw out the following question to his class. He said, if you had a relative who died, and Akash Baruch Hu told all the Mason, you can come back to this world for 1 hour. He says, what do you think the dead people would want to do in the 1 hour in this world? You think they'd want to go visit their family? They'd want to see how the business is working? They'd want to see where the grandkids? He says, I guarantee you, every dead person would run into as many mitzvahs as he can. Because once they're in that side, they already realize how important this world is. But it's too late. There's nothing they can do. So therefore, he's saying that we have to appreciate that this is the time for now. Now we gotta start saving. It's too late then. Once the 7 years of hunger start, it's too late. There's nothing left. Now you got to deal with whatever work you put in. So therefore, that was the lesson that Yosef was telling Pharaoh. You got to have some of those big visions. If you're going to have a person who only looks at the right now, this is not going to work. So he told him, you have to have someone who's an ish navayim v'chacham. Someone who's able to see the big picture. He's someone who can lead the country to the next economic state. The Medrash points out something very interesting. The Medrash says that when it comes to Yosef's life, his makkah and refuah came from the exact same way. How did Yosef, so to say, get hit? He was thrown into jail. When Yosef was thrown into jail, he could not have seen any good to come from this. Yet, how was he saved? He was saved from jail. By jail. Because of being in jail, he met the Sar HaMashkim. The Sar HaMashkim got him out, and he was saved. Says the Medrash, that's not the way human beings work. The way it works in this world is a person gets a makkah, and then the doctor gives him a band-aid. It's not the same thing that hits you, cures you. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world differently. The same exact thing that afflicted him, that caused him so much pain, would be the exact same thing that turned out to be his Yeshua. That's because Hashem runs the world. When Hashem runs the world, nothing that is negative can necessarily have to be negative. It's negative at the time. But it could be exactly the source of the Yeshua later on. The quote from one of the great Gedolim, they said that, you know, we talk about learning Musar and Musar Sfarim. If a person just looked at his life, his daily, day-to-day running, and said to himself, I see Yad Hashem, that could be the greatest Musar Sefer in the world. You see, we don't always think about it. That if I missed this and I got this, and every little step along the way looks to us like the biggest casualty in the world. But because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not a boss of Adam, his greatest casualty could be the exact same source of the greatest salvation. And therefore, that's why the bar, this exact same bar, and being in a jail cell, which to the naked eye, and even to Yosef at the time, seemed to be the worst thing in the world, ultimately turned out to be his salvation. The Chafetz Chaim points out that the pasuk tells us that everything happened so fast, that Pari came down and whisked him out of jail, and that was it. Says the Chafetz Chaim, this alludes to the idea of the Geula. The same way that everything can happen so fast. It doesn't have to be a whole long procedure. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu says it's done, we're done. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu said this Pliny suffered enough, the suffering ends. In the middle of whatever it's going on. That's it, it ends. In the middle of whatever it's up to, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu says it's over, it's over. So says the Chafetz Chaim, and same thing with the Galus. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu finally says it's over, it's going to end. No matter what's going on, we could be in the middle of a million things. It's going to end, boom, it's over. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is cheshbens exactly, and when it's over, that's it. Everything happens keherifying. That's why we say, Chazal tell us, Yeshua Hashem keherifying. Everything can happen extremely quickly when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, now it's time for it to happen. So what happens? Yosef now is a big deal. And Pari makes a big deal about him. It's interesting. Pari gives a lot of credence to Yosef. He was going to be his financial advisor. You don't have to necessarily make him the second highest ranking member of society. You can make him your financial advisor and that's it. And you can retain your power. He gives a lot of power over to Yosef. If you look in the Pesukim, the Pasuk says something very interesting. Yosef tells Pari, you have to find someone who's an ish, navon, v'chacham. And the Pasuk tells us that v'yitav adave, the Pari be'ine kavadav, everyone liked this idea. V'yemei Pari levadav, so Pari asks avadim, who do you think we can find better than Yosef? Why did Pari need to ask his avodim? He's a dictator. Dictators don't ask anyone what they want. They do what they want. You have to get their permission. So the Ramban writes something very interesting. He writes that society, socially speaking, the Mitzrayim were repulsed by Jews. Repulsed. That's the lesson the Ramban uses. Repulsed. Pari knew this is a major, major move. If I'm going to bring in a Jew and bring in such a high ranking, I got to make sure this is going to fly with society. Although he was a dictator. He also knew that there are certain things that the people just won't stand for. If I'm going to bring in a Jew that everyone can't stand, and I'm going to make him high-ranking, unless I can justify this move, I'm going to get a lot of pushback. So if we ask the Zavodim, guys, do you think this is going to fly with the people? And they said, yeah, this is good. We're going to love this. He's good for taxes. Everyone's going to take him. Don't worry, right? No one minds. So if they're fine, I'm going to take him. But the Ramban writes such strong lashoness about the hatred that the Mitzrayim had. And yet, you see, with all the hatred, when it made sense financially, he had no problem putting him in the position. But as much as they, you know, didn't like the Jews, again, I'm not sure how many Jews they saw. How many Jews were in Mitzrayim at that time? You know, I'm not sure. But he had this very strong hatred towards the Jewish people. The Pasuk tells us that Pari is now thrilled. He now appoints Yosef to be second in command. He takes off his ring. He gives him clothing. He rides him on a horse. So Chaim Kanevsky is also bothered. How can he go on the horse in Yom Tov? It's Rosh Hashanah. It's a chushtikal taira. He says because he wasn't pushing the animal, someone else was riding the animal, and it was mutter because it was covered in malchus. Maybe this is where Jared Kushner got his heter also, to fly in the plane. I'm not sure. He maybe got from this parsha. The same way that Yosef was allowed to go on a horse on Rosh Hashanah because it was covered in malchus. It's only, he held it's only this is the Rabbanon, and because of covered Amalchus, it was mutter, so maybe that's where he got his heta from. I don't know. He got it from this week's parsha, possibly. But nonetheless, Yosef ran on the horse in Rosh Hashanah. And then all of a sudden, now it's time for him to get married. He can't be second in command without a wife. He needs a wife. So Pari tells him, I have a great shidduch for you. Who's the great shidduch that he has for him? He tells him, I want you to marry Osnas Bas Poitifera. Osnas, the daughter of Poitifera. Who's Poitifera? So Mishanim will speak out. This is Poitifera. So now, if you think about it, this is very strange. He's going to marry the daughter of his alleged victim. In last week's parasha, he was accused of rape. And he's going to marry her daughter. That looks, something looks very strange in this equation. And that generally wouldn't happen. So the Kliyok and the Mefarshim will talk about this. Why was this the one he married? Secondly, if Pari's second in command, shouldn't he have taken some form of royalty as a wife? Why would he take what we call a simpleton, a hetyot? He's now such a high-ranking member of society, he's going to take a regular person. So the answer is, sometimes that happens. You take royalty marries none. That's going on in England now. I think the next prince is marrying not royalty. Okay, his brother did it also. He's really breaking the malucha. Okay, whatever it is, sometimes it happens. But they say the Kliyaka is a beautiful pshat. The Kliyaka says they did this bedafka to show everyone that Yosef was innocent. I'll prove all the alleged crimes from last week's parasha are not true. Because I'm going to marry my victim's daughter. If it's true that I talked to something not right with her, would they really let me marry their daughter? It doesn't make any sense. So he bedafka married the daughter of Paitifar, to show everyone that there was no validity whatsoever to all the claims on last week's parasha. It's not true. He didn't do anything wrong. And that's why he bedafka married. The Medrash quotes, Mishanim quotes this, that this girl that he married was none other than the daughter of Dina. The way the Medrash says is that Dina got pregnant, and they shipped Dina, they sent her out. They didn't want her having this baby, and this baby was Dina's daughter. And Yaakov wrote a kamir. He wrote a note on her that she's from Yaakov's family, and she found her way down to Mitzrayim. So why is she called Osnas Bas Poitifera? So they say, based on the Gemara and Ksubis, that she was raised in their home. And anyone who raises a child in their house is as if they gave birth to them. So therefore, this was really Bas Dina. But Lined, when we get to Parshas Vayechi, we'll talk more about this connection, about whether or not this is really Baz Dina or not. But nonetheless, that's why.
That's why you have to be Mechabes step parent.
Yeah, this is this Gemara that of Kol HaMagadli Yosef Yisrael Mizrach Beis is a very big chiddush. Reb Shlomo Kluger, on the first page in Eben Ezer, writes a real chiddush. He writes that if a person adopts a child, they yotze the mitzvah peruvah. It's a very controversial psak. It doesn't seem to be accepted. But that's what he writes. He writes that if a person adopts a child, he's become the mitzvah of peruvu. The Lubavitcher Rebbe used to tell people not to adopt because he held there's too many yichud shailas that come up with adoption. So they say over an unbelievable story that a guy once called Rabbi Salvechik and asked him that he wanted to adopt a child as a mutter. So if Salvechik held, you're allowed to adopt. So if Salvechik realized something was wrong over here, if Salvechik asked him, he said, who do you normally ask your shailas to? So it came out the guy was a Chabad chassid. So he said, I know why you're calling me, because you can't call your Rebbe. Your Rebbe will tell you not to adopt. So Salvechik said, I can't give you a heter. I know your Rebbe, Salvechik and the Lubavitcher Rebbe were quite close, so he knew this. So he told the fellow, I can't give you a heter. So he said, but I'll give you a bracha. In a year from now, Mitzvah Shem, you should have your own baby. And kachave, a year later, this guy had his own baby. No one knew that Salvechik was a Rebbe also. Look at that. Who knew? He's a Rebbe. But that's the way the story goes, that he gave him a bracha, and the guy was able to have children. At the end, right after all this great stuff about Yosef's life, not only has he made it financially, not only is he making ranking in society, he's zeichet to have children. The Pasuk tells us he has two children, two boys. And he has them before the hunger starts, because as the Gemara writes in Tanya, a person is not allowed to have tashmish, not have relations during hunger. That's a whole discussion of the Gemara over there. If he didn't have peruvu, was he not yet yetzer peruvu? He has yetzer peruvu. But he has two children, and what's interesting is the name that he gives to his first son. His firstborn child, Menashe. What does he call him? Ki nashani elikim es kol amaliv es kol beisi. I forgot all of my father's house. You would thought that is not exactly the name someone like Yosef would choose. I forgot all of my father's house. I forgot all my upbringing. That sounds like a casualty, not something to celebrate. So Rabbi Frank quotes a beautiful idea. He says, Yosef was a very practical fellow. He said, I grew up in Yaakov's house. Yeah, I know. But my son is not growing up in Yaakov's house. He's growing up in Mitzrayim. If I'm going to keep all the hakpadas and all the chumras and all the things that I did by my father's house, it's not going to work here. It's not going to work. It's a different society. It's a different world. So when he said over here, when he forgot his father's house, doesn't mean he forgot all the right things to do. He knew exactly. But he knew he has to kind of alter things a little bit to fit the world that he's now having over here with Menashe. He says to himself, my son's being raised in Mitzrayim. What am I going to do? I'm going to be Machpon HaChol of Yisrael now over here in Mitzrayim? Well, what am I supposed to do? It is what it is. It's a reality. So he said that I'm not forgetting what's important. I'm not forgetting where I come from. I know. But I also have to change because if I'm going to live in the Altaheim society, it's not going to work. So he said over here, Rabbi Franz said, he heard this var from Rabbi Yomeir Bloch, who said this in 1943. 1943, he said, the world is changing. And Rabbi Franz reminds us, he says, you know, those European Jews who came after the war and they wanted to live shtetl European life in America, it didn't work. It's a different world. If you're going to live that lifestyle, this generation couldn't handle it. So therefore, this wasn't a taina on Yosef. It was actually a good thing. He realized that I'm in a different society now. I have to raise my children differently. I can't be machped on the same things I was when I was by my father. I had more flexibility. Here I'm much more restricted. I have to realize this is what it is. And therefore, that's why he named his son Menashe, to show him that I didn't forget where I came from. Instead, I realized that I have to kind of alter my chinuch. I have to rearrange some of my priorities. I have to make sure I'm giving over the right messages because he's living in a totally different society. Yosef is raising children in a very different world than he was raised. And the job of a parent is to realize sometimes I have to be able to change the proper hashkafas that I have to make it fit the society where I'm raising my own children. And that's why Yosef is not a taina on him. Instead, it was actually a shvach for him that the way he named his children and the way he ultimately raised his children while living in a Mitzri society.